Chapter 10. At the third stroke, it will be 1:32:20. Beep, beep, beep. Ford Prefect suppressed a little giggle of evil satisfaction, realized that he had no reason to suppress it, and laughed out loud, a wicked laugh. He switched the incoming signal through from the sub-Ethernet to the ship's superb hi-fi system, and the odd, rather stilted sing-song voice spoke out with remarkable clarity round the cabin. At the third stroke, it will be 1:32:30. Beep, beep, beep. He tweaked the volume up just a little, while keeping a careful eye on a rapidly changing table of figures on the ship's computer display. For the length of time he had in mind, the question of power consumption became significant. He didn't want a murder on his conscience. At the third stroke, it will be 1:32:40. Beep, beep, beep. He checked around the small ship. He walked down the short corridor. At the third stroke, he stuck his head into a small, functional, gleaming steel bathroom. It will be... It sounded fine in there. He looked into the tiny sleeping quarters. 1:32. It sounded a bit muffled. There was a towel hanging over one of the speakers. He took down the towel. And 50 seconds. Fine. He checked out the packed cargo hold and wasn't at all satisfied with the sound. There was altogether too much crated junk in the way. He stepped back out and waited for the door to seal. He broke open a closed control panel and pushed the jettison button. He didn't know why he hadn't thought of that before. A whooshing, rumbling noise died away quickly into silence. After a pause, a slight hiss could be heard again. It stopped. He waited for the green light to show and then opened the door again on the now empty cargo hold. 1:33:50. Very nice. Beep, beep, beep. He then went and had a last thorough examination of the emergency suspended animation chamber, which was where he particularly wanted it to be heard. At the third stroke, it will be 1:34, precisely. He shivered as he peered down through the heavily frosted covering at the dim bulk of the form within. One day, who knew when, it would wake, and when it did, it would know what time it was. Not exactly local time, true, but what the heck. He double-checked the computer display above the freezer bed, dimmed the lights, and checked it again. At the third stroke, it will be... He tiptoed out and returned to the control cabin. 1:34:20. The voice sounded as clear as if he was hearing it over a phone in London, which he wasn't. Not by a long way. He gazed out into the inky night. The star, the size of a brilliant biscuit crumb he could see in the distance, was Zondostina, or, as it was known in the world, from which the rather stilted sing-song voice was being received, Pleiades Zeta. The bright orange curve that filled over half the visible area was the giant gas planet Sesiphrus Magna, where the Zaxisian battleships docked, and rising over its horizon was a small, cool blue moon, Epon. At the third stroke, it will be... For 20 minutes he sat and watched as the gap between the ship and Epon closed, as the ship's computer teased and kneaded the numbers that would bring it into a loop around the little moon, close the loop, and keep it there, orbiting in perpetual obscurity. 1:59. His original plan had been to close down all external signalling and radiation from the ship, to render it as nearly invisible as possible, unless you were actually looking at it. But then he'd had an idea he preferred. It would now emit one single continuous beam, pencil-thin, broadcasting the incoming time signal to the planet of the signal's origin, which he would not reach for 400 years, travelling at light speed, but where it would probably cause something of a stir when it did. Beep, 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 he sniggered. He didn't like to think of himself as the sort of person who giggled or sniggered, but he had to admit that he had been giggling and sniggering almost continuously for well over half an hour now. At the third stroke, the ship was now locked almost perfectly into its perpetual orbit round a little-known and never-visited moon. Almost perfect. One thing only remained. He ran again the computer simulation of the launching of the ship's little escapo buggy, balancing actions, reactions, tangential forces, all the mathematical poetry of motion, and saw that it was good. Before he left, he turned out the lights. As his tiny little cigar tube of an escape craft zipped out on the beginning of its 3-day journey to the orbiting space station Port Sessaphron, it rode for a few seconds a long, pencil-thin beam of radiation that was starting out on a longer journey still. At the third stroke, it will be 2:13:50 seconds. He giggled and sniggered. He would have laughed out loud, but he didn't have room. Beep, beep, beep. Chapter 11. April showers I hate especially. However non-committally Arthur grunted, the man seemed determined to talk to him. He wondered if he should get up and move to another table, but there didn't seem to be one free in the whole cafeteria. He stirred his coffee fiercely. Bloody April showers! Hate, hate, hate! Arthur stared, frowning, out of the window. A light, sunny spray of rain hung over the motorway. 2 months he'd been back now. Slipping back into his old life had in fact been laughably easy. People had such extraordinarily short memories, including him. 8 years of crazed wanderings around the galaxy now seemed to him not so much like a bad dream as like a film he had videotaped from the TV and now kept in the back of a cupboard without bothering to watch. One effect that still lingered, though, was his joy at being back. Now that the Earth's atmosphere had closed over its head for good, he thought, wrongly, everything within it gave him extraordinary pleasure. Looking at the silvery sparkle of the raindrops, he felt he had to protest. "Well, I like them," he said suddenly, "and for all the obvious reasons, they're light and refreshing. They sparkle and make you feel good." The man snorted derisively. "That's what they all say," he said, and glowered darkly from his corner seat. He was a lorry driver. Arthur knew this because his opening, unprovoked remark had been, "I'm a lorry driver. I hate driving in the rain. Ironic, isn't it? Bloody ironic." If there was a sequitur hidden in this remark, Arthur had not been able to divine it, and had merely given a little grunt, affable but not encouraging. But the man had not been deterred then, and was not deterred now. "They all say that about bloody April showers," he said. "So bloody nice, so bloody refreshing, such charming bloody weather." He leaned forward, screwing his face up as if he was going to say something extraordinary about the government. "What I want to know is this," he said. "If it's going to be nice weather, why," he almost spat, "can't it be nice without bloody raining?" Arthur gave up. He decided to leave his coffee, which was too hot to drink quickly, and too nasty to drink cold. "Well, there you go," he said, and instead got up himself. "Bye." He stopped off at the service station shop, then walked back through the car park, making a point of enjoying the fine play of rain on his face. There was even, he noticed, a faint rainbow glistening over the Devon Hills. He enjoyed that, too. He climbed into his battered but adored old black Golf GTI, squealed the tyres, and headed out past the islands of petrol pumps and onto the slip road back towards the motorway. He was wrong in thinking that the atmosphere of the Earth had closed finally and forever above his head. He was wrong to think that it would ever be possible to put behind him the tangled web of irresolutions into which his galactic travels had dragged him. He was wrong to think he could now forget that the big, hard, oily, dirty, rainbow-hung Earth on which he lived was a microscopic dot on a microscopic dot, lost in the unimaginable infinity of the universe. He drove on, humming, being wrong about all these things. The reason he was wrong was standing by the slip road under a small umbrella. His jaw sagged. He sprained his ankle against the brake pedal and skidded so hard he very nearly turned the car over. "Fenny!" he shouted. Having narrowly avoided hitting her with the actual car, he hit her instead with the car door as he leant across and flung it open at her. It caught her hand and knocked away her umbrella, which then bowled wildly away across the road. "Shit!" yelled Arthur as helpful as he could, leapt out of his own door, narrowly avoided being run down by McKenna's all-weather haulage, and watched in horror as it ran down Fenny's umbrella instead. The lorry swept along the motorway and away. The umbrella lay like a recently swatted daddy longlegs, expiring sadly on the ground. Tiny gusts of wind made it twitch a little. He picked it up. He said, there didn't seem to be a lot of point in offering the thing back to her. How did you know my name? She said. Oh, well, he said, look, I'll get you another one. He looked at her and tailed off. She was tallish, with dark hair which fell in waves around a pale and serious face. Standing still, alone, she seemed almost somber, like a statue to some important but unpopular virtue in a formal garden. She seemed to be looking at something other than what she looked as if she was looking at. But when she smiled, as she did now, it was as if she suddenly arrived from somewhere. Warmth and life flooded into her face, an impossibly graceful movement into her body. The effect was very disconcerting, and it disconcerted Arthur like hell. She grinned, tossed her bag into the back, and swiveled herself into the front seat. Don't worry about the umbrella, she said to him as she climbed in. It was my brother's, and he can't have liked it, or he wouldn't have given it to me. She laughed and pulled on her seatbelt. You're not a friend of my brother's, are you? No. Her voice was the only part of her which didn't say good. Her physical presence there in the car, his car, was quite extraordinary to Arthur. He felt, as he let the car pull slowly away, that he could hardly think or breathe, and hoped that neither of these functions were vital to his driving, or they were in trouble. So what he had experienced in the other car, her brother's car, the night he had returned exhausted and bewildered from his nightmare years in the stars, had not been the unbalance of the moment. Or if it had been, he was at least twice as unbalanced now, and quite liable to fall off whatever it is that well-balanced people are supposed to be balancing on. So, he said, hoping to kick the conversation off to an exciting start. He was supposed to pick me up, my brother, but phoned to say he couldn't make it. I asked about buses, but the man started to look at a calendar rather than a timetable, so I decided to hitch. So, said Arthur. So here I am, and what I would like to know is how you know my name. Perhaps we ought to first sort out, said Arthur, looking back over his shoulder as he eased his car into the motorway traffic, where I'm taking you. Very close, he hoped, or a long way. Close would mean she lived near him. A long way would mean he could drive her there. I'd like to go to Taunton, she said. Please, if that's all right, it's not far, you can drop me at... You live in Taunton? He said, hoping that he'd managed to sound merely curious rather than ecstatic. Taunton was wonderfully close to him. He could... No, London, she said, there's a train in just under an hour. It was the worst thing possible. Taunton was only minutes away up the motorway. He wondered what to do, and while he was wondering, with horror, heard himself saying, Oh, I can take you to London, and let me take you to London. Bungling idiot. Why on earth had he said let in that stupid way? He was behaving like a 12-year-old. Are you going to London? She asked. I wasn't, he said, but... Bungling idiot. It's very kind of you, she said, but really, no, I like to go by train. And suddenly she was gone. Or rather, that part of her which brought her to life was gone. She looked rather distantly out of the window and hummed lightly to herself. He couldn't believe it. 30 seconds into the conversation, and already he'd blown it. Grown men, he told himself, in flat contradiction of centuries of accumulated evidence about the way grown men behave, do not behave like this. Taunton, 5 miles, said the signpost. He gripped the steering wheel so tightly the car wobbled. He was going to have to do something dramatic. Fenny, he said. She glanced round sharply at him. You haven't told me how... Listen, said Arthur, I will tell you that the story is rather strange, very strange. She was still looking at him, but said nothing. Listen, you said that. Did I? Oh, there are things I must talk to you about, and things I must tell you, a story I must tell you which would... He was thrashing about. He wanted to say something along the lines of, Thy knotted and combined locks to part, and each particular hair to stand on end like quills upon the fretful porpentine, but didn't think he could carry it off, and didn't like the hedgehog reference. Which would take more than 5 miles, he settled for in the end, rather lamely, he was afraid. Well? Just supposing, he said, just supposing, he didn't know what was coming next, so he thought he'd just sit back and listen, that there was some extraordinary way in which you were very important to me, and that, though you didn't know it, I was very important to you, but it all went for nothing because we only had 5 miles and I was a stupid idiot at not knowing how to say something very important to someone I'd only just met and not crash into Laura's at the same time. What would you say, he paused helplessly and looked at her, I should do? Watch the road, she yelped. Shit! He narrowly avoided careering into the side of 100 Italian washing machines and a German lorry. I think, she said with a momentary sigh of relief, you should buy me a drink before my train goes. Chapter 12. There is, for some reason, something especially grim about pubs near stations. A very particular kind of grubbiness, a special kind of pallor to the pork pies. Worse than the pork pies, though, are the sandwiches. There is a feeling which persists in England that making a sandwich interesting, attractive, or in any way pleasant to eat is something sinful that only foreigners do. Make 'em dry is the instruction buried somewhere in the collective national consciousness. Make 'em rubbery. If you have to keep the buggers fresh, do it by washing 'em once a week. It is by eating sandwiches in pubs on Saturday lunchtimes that the British seek to atone for whatever their national sins have been. They're not altogether clear what those sins are, and don't want to know either. Sins are not the sort of things one wants to know about. But whatever sins there are amply atoned for by the sandwiches they make themselves eat. If there is anything worse than the sandwiches, it is the sausages which sit next to them, joyless tubes full of gristle, floating in a sea of something hot and sad, stuck with a plastic pin in the shape of a chef's hat. A memorial, one feels, for some chef who hated the world and died forgotten and alone among his cats in a back stair in Stepney. The sausages are for the ones who know what their sins are and wish to atone for something specific. There must be somewhere better, said Arthur. No time, said Fanny, glancing at her watch. My train leaves in half an hour. They sat at a small wobbly table. On it were some dirty glasses and some soggy beer mats with jokes printed on them. Arthur got Fanny a tomato juice and himself a pint of yellow water with gas in it, and a couple of sausages. He didn't know why. He bought them for something to do while the gas settled in his glass. The barman dunked Arthur's change in a pool of beer on the bar, for which Arthur thanked him. All right, said Fanny, glancing at her watch. Tell me what it is you have to tell me. She sounded, as well she might, extremely sceptical, and Arthur's heart sank. Hardly, he felt, the most conducive setting to try to explain to her, as she sat there, suddenly cool and defensive, that in a sort of out-of-body dream he had had a telepathic sense that the mental breakdown she had suffered had been connected with the fact that, appearances to the contrary notwithstanding, the Earth had been demolished to make way for a new hyperspace bypass, something which he alone on Earth knew anything about, having virtually witnessed it from a Vogon spaceship, and that furthermore both his body and soul ached for her unbearably, and he needed to go to bed with her as soon as was humanly possible. Fanny, he started. I wonder if you'd like to buy some tickets for our raffle. It's just a little one. He glanced up sharply. To raise money for Angie, who's retiring. What? And needs a kidney machine. He was being leant over by a rather stiffly slim, middle-aged woman with a prim knitted suit, a prim little perm, and a prim little smile that probably got licked by prim little dogs a lot. She was holding out a small book of cloakroom tickets and a collecting tin. Only 10 pence each, she said, so you could probably even buy two, without breaking the bank. She gave a tinkly little laugh and then a curiously long sigh, saying, without breaking the bank, had obviously given her more pleasure than anything since some GIs had been billeted on her during the war. Yes, all right, said Arthur, hurriedly digging in his pocket and producing a couple of coins. With infuriating slowness and prim theatricality, if there was such a thing, the woman tore off 2 tickets and handed them to Arthur. I do hope you win, she said with a smile that suddenly snapped together like a piece of advanced origami. The prizes are so nice. Yes, thank you, said Arthur, pocketing the tickets rather brusquely and glancing at his watch. He turned towards Fanny. So did the woman with the raffle tickets. And what about you, young lady? She said. It's for Angie's kidney machine. She's retiring, you see. Yes. She hoisted the little smile even further up her face. She would have to stop and let it go soon, or the skin would surely split. Look, here you are, said Arthur, and pushed a 50-pence piece at her in the hope that that would see her off. Oh, we are in the money, aren't we? Said the woman with a long, smiling sigh. "Down from London, are we?" Arthur wished he wouldn't talk so bloody slowly. "No, that's all right, really," he said with a wave of his hand, as she started with awful deliberation to peel off 5 tickets, one by one. "Oh, but you must have our tickets," insisted the woman, "or you won't be able to claim your prize. They're very nice prizes, you know, very suitable." Arthur snatched the tickets and said thank you as sharply as he could. The woman turned to Fenny once again. "And now what about—" "No!" Arthur nearly yelled. "These are for her," he explained, brandishing the 5 new tickets. "Oh, I see. How nice." She smiled sickeningly at both of them. "Well, I do hope—" "Yes," snapped Arthur, "thank you." The woman finally departed to the table next to theirs. Arthur turned desperately to Fenny, and was relieved to see that she was rocking with silent laughter. He smiled and sighed. "Where were we?" he said. "You were calling me Fenny, and I was about to ask you not to." "What do you mean?" She twirled the little wooden cocktail stick in her tomato juice. "It's why I asked if you were a friend of my brother's, or half-brother, really. He's the only one who calls me Fenny, and I'm not fond of him for it." "So what's Benchurch?"
"What?"
"Benchurch."
"Benchurch?"
She looked at him sternly. "Yes," she said, "and I'm watching you like a lynx to see if you're going to ask the same silly question that everyone asks me till I want to scream. I shall be cross and disappointed if you do. Plus, I shall scream, so watch it." She smiled, shook her hair a little forward over her face, and peered at him from behind it. "Oh," he said, "that's a little unfair, isn't it?"
"Yes."
"Fine." "All right," she said with a laugh. "You can ask me. Might as well get it over with. Better than have you call me Fenny the whole time."
"Presumably," said Arthur. "We've only got 2 tickets left, you see, and since you were so generous when I spoke to you before—"
"What?" snapped Arthur. The woman with the perm and the smile and the now nearly empty book of cloakroom tickets was now waving the 2 last ones under his nose.
"I thought I'd give the opportunity to you because the prizes are so nice."
She wrinkled up her nose a little confidentially.
"Very tasteful. I know you like them. And it is for Angie's retirement present, you see. We want to give her—"
"A kidney machine, yes," said Arthur. "Here." He held out 2 more 10-pence pieces to her and took the tickets. A thought seemed to strike the woman. It struck her very slowly. You could watch it coming in like a long wave on a sandy beach.
"Oh, dear," she said. "I'm not interrupting anything, am I?"
She peered anxiously at both of them. "No, it's fine," said Arthur. "Everything that could possibly be fine," he insisted, "is fine. Thank you," he added.
"I say," she said, in a delighted ecstasy of worry, "you're not in love, are you?"
"It's very hard to say," said Arthur. "We haven't had a chance to talk yet." He glanced at Fenchurch. She was grinning. The woman nodded with knowing confidentiality.
"I'll let you see the prizes in a minute," she said, and left.
Arthur turned, with a sigh, back to the girl that he found it hard to say whether he was in love with.
"You were about to ask me," she said, "a question."
"Yes," said Arthur. "We can do it together, if you like," said Fenchurch. "Was I found in a handbag," joined in Arthur, "in the left luggage office," they said together, "at Fenchurch Street Station," they finished. "And the answer," said Fenchurch, "is no." "Fine," said Arthur.
"I was conceived there."
"What?
I was con—"
"In the left luggage office?" hooted Arthur.
"No, of course not. Don't be silly.
What would my parents be doing in the left luggage office?" she said, rather taken aback by the suggestion.
"Well, I don't know," spluttered Arthur. "Or rather, it was in the ticket queue."
The ticket queue, or so they claim. They refuse to elaborate. They only say you wouldn't believe how bored it is possible to get in the ticket queue at Fenchurch Street Station. She sipped demurely at her tomato juice and looked at her watch. Arthur continued to gurgle for a moment or two. "I'm going to have to go in a minute or two," said Fenchurch, "and you haven't begun to tell me whatever this terrifically extraordinary thing is that you're so keen to get off your chest." "Why don't you let me drive you to London?" said Arthur. "It's Saturday, I've got nothing particular to do, I'd—"
"No," said Fenchurch. "Thank you, it's sweet of you, but no. I need to be by myself for a couple of days."
She smiled and shrugged.
"But
you can tell me another time. I'll give you my number." Arthur's heart went boom, boom, churn, churn, as she scribbled 7 figures in pencil on a scrap of paper and handed it to him. Now we can relax, she said with a slow smile, which filled Arthur till he thought he would burst. Fenchurch, he said, enjoying the name as he said it.
A box, said a trailing voice, of cherry liqueurs, and also, and I know you like this, a gramophone record of Scottish bagpipe music.
Yes, thank you, very nice, insisted Arthur.
I just thought I'd let you have a look at them, said the permed woman, as you're down from London.
She was holding them out proudly for Arthur to see. He could see that they were indeed a box of cherry brandy liqueurs and a record of bagpipe music. That was what they were.
I'll let you have your drink in peace now, she said, patting Arthur lightly on his seething shoulder, but I knew you'd like to see.
Arthur re-engaged his eyes with Fenchurch's once again, and suddenly was at a loss for something to say. A moment had come and gone between the two of them, but the whole rhythm of it had been wrecked by that stupid, blasted woman. Don't worry, said Fenchurch, looking at him steadily from over the top of her glass. We will talk again. She took a sip. Perhaps, she added, it wouldn't have gone so well if it wasn't for her. She gave a wry smile and dropped her hair forward over her face again. It was perfectly true. He had to admit it was perfectly true. End of side 4.